In this weekend episode, three segments from this week's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN. First, a discussion about this week's final report from the House January 6th Select Committee with former Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Robbins. Then Cato Institute's Stephen Beer discusses the Supreme Court's decision to extend Title 42 border restrictions. Plus, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine John Herbst discusses Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to the U.S. this week in a bid to rally support for his country's war effort. We begin with a discussion about the January 6th Select Committee's final report and its potential impact on the ongoing Justice Department investigation.
Joining us now is Jeff Robbins. He served as the former Senate Minority Chief Counsel for the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. He was the former Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts. Joining us now to talk about the congressional investigation of January 6th. Mr. Robbins, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you expand on your role that you served in Congress, particularly in the role of investigations and how Congress investigates things or events and things?
Yes. So I was simultaneously chief counsel for the Democrats, the minority at the time, for something called the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which is a great subcommittee with a significant bipartisan tradition. And then at the same time, I was deputy chief counsel, again for the minority, for the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, the full committee, which at the time was investigating allegations that there were improprieties by the Clinton-Gore campaign in the 1996 election.
With that background in mind, sir, what did you think about the committee's the January 6th committee's criminal referrals to the Justice Department on its face as far as the specific referrals?
Well, first, the underlying volume of serious work that was done by this committee, nobody, regardless, it seems to me, of their political inclination, can challenge. I mean, this was 1,000 witnesses, nearly about 1 million documents. The executive summary of this report that's being released tomorrow runs 150 pages, 762 footnotes. When you have an executive summary that is longer than Winston Churchill's six-volume history of World War II, you know you're dealing with a serious document. With respect to the referrals, there is obviously an enormous amount of evidence that supports each of the referrals. That is not, however, to say that that ends the equation as far as the Justice Department lawyers on the receiving end of those referrals are concerned, because they have a very different calculus to make. They have to assess whether or not that evidence, number one, is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that will enable them to proceed with some confidence that they can persuade a jury of 12 unanimously that there has been proof beyond a reasonable doubt, so much so to convict a former president, which is obviously has never occurred before. So while I think that the charges clearly are supported by evidence, that is very far from the end of the equation as far as the Justice Department or the special counsel lawyers who now have to review that are concerned.
Obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to make a false statement, and inciting, assisting, and giving aid to comfort to the insurrection. Are you saying you can find evidence in what was presented directly to former President Trump on those fronts?
Yes, for certain. But on the other hand, and it should be noted, for example, that with respect to the first two charges, conspiracy to impede and conspiracy to defraud, which are very related, there's a federal judge who, ruling on a very narrow sliver of the evidence that the committee had before it, Judge Carter in California, wrote a decision finding that, in his view, it was likelier than not that the former president had violated those criminal statutes. So, yes, of course, there is evidence supporting each of the four, and there's enough evidence of corrupt intent, which is an element that really straddles all four of these potential charges, you know, to sink a ship. I mean, we're not talking about a mountain of evidence of corrupt intent. We're talking about a mountain range at this point. But that is not to say that the former president would not have significant defenses in the event that those charges are brought. And that's what the Justice Department lawyers and the special counsel lawyers have to assess. There'll be a lot of sleepless nights over at the Justice Department, probably already have been, asking, with people asking themselves the question, okay, I get it, but can I persuade a jury of 12 unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt, that that the former president is guilty, especially where are there are these defenses which are related to, you know, speech and asking lawyers for advice and the like.
We've seen the committee refer other criminal referrals to the Justice Department. The Justice Department took some, did not take others. What's the deliberative process like in determining what's done with it?
Well, number one, and has been said, I think, a lot over the last 24 to 36 hours, the fact of the referral is of no consequence. In other words, the Justice Department, traditionally, there have been some blips along the way, including, in my view, under the Trump administration, is an institution which prides itself on its independence. It prides itself on holding itself to very, very tough standards. And frankly, it knows that the federal judges before whom its lawyers appear will hold them to very, very tough standards. So what there will be is an independent review of the evidence that is sent over, the transcripts and the documents, in conjunction with the evidence that the Justice Department lawyers have already amassed. And the analysis will be independent of whether or not seven members of a congressional committee, however smart they are, and some of the members on the committee are actually not just smart but very good lawyers, but there'll be an independent test. And that test, as I say, will be charge by charge with respect to those four and other potential charges. A, is there evidence beyond a reasonable doubt? B, is there a great deal of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt? And C, given the anticipated defenses, how likely is it that we can prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that under these extraordinary circumstances, a former president should be found guilty of charges which would send him or could well send him to prison?
Mr. Robbins, you talked about the idea of, you know, possibly charging a president. How much does it matter that he's running for office?
Well, I think at this point we're beyond that. In other words, I think that I take the Attorney General at face value when he says that that really can't be a factor. And certainly the appointment of a special counsel is a strong indication that it really will not be a factor. And the special counsel who has been appointed is a very experienced prosecutor. I don't think, in fact, the fact that the former president is running for re-election is going to have any impact on this deliberation. The deliberation will be really, is this an indictable offense? Is it clearly an indictable offense? Is there a significant quantum of proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And how valid are the anticipated defenses?
You brought up the special counsel. It's conducting its investigation of these referrals coming into the Justice Department. Is there any crossover between the two?
Well, I think that the special counsel's office will be staffed in part or substantially by Justice Department prosecutors who have already been not only sifting evidence but actually presenting evidence to a grand jury. I mean, this Justice Department has already done a lot of work before the handoff to the special counsel, negotiating with witnesses, presenting witnesses to the grand jury. So it's not as if this special counsel is starting from square one, because he surely is not.
Let me follow up then. If the Justice Department or if the House delivers its report or evidence that's associated with that, can the special counsel take the evidence that's brought in from these criminal referrals and use it in its own case?
Oh, very much so. In fact, that is really the principal value of this mega tome or series of tomes of evidence that are being turned over by the committee to the Justice Department. There are reams and reams of transcripts of sworn testimony that can be presented to a grand jury. There are reams of documents that can themselves be presented to a grand jury or can form the basis for presentation to the grand jury. So, and that, by the way, is why apparently the Justice Department has been pressing the committee to turn over these transcripts before now, for reasons which are perplexing. The committee was reluctant to do that. But now that the evidence is being turned over by the committee to the special counsel, there are just treasure troves of evidence that can be used in concrete fashion by the special counsel's office.
When it comes to the referrals from yesterday, ultimately, will it be the Attorney General Merrick Garland that makes the decision?
Yes. There'll be a recommendation by the special counsel, but ultimately it will be the Attorney General who makes the decision.
That was former Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Robbins. Next, we discuss the situation at the border and the Supreme Court's decision this week to delay lifting Title 42 restrictions. That conversation now with Stephen Beer, Cato Institute's Associate Director of Immigration Studies.
The most important thing to understand about Title 42, we need to back up to understand the context. Title 42 is not an immigration policy. Title 42 is part of the public health code of the United States. And what that law says is it says the Centers for Disease Control can issue an order that blocks the entry of persons or things carrying potentially contagious diseases. So it is not about immigrants per se. Of course, the government is only applying it to non-citizens entering without advanced authorization to travel to this country. But in theory, this law can be applied to U.S. citizens. It can be applied to anyone trying to enter the United States legally or otherwise. And so the public health nature of this law is at the center of this debate and this controversy, because what the CDC and what the Trump administration and Biden administration have said is that they can use this law to suspend any laws, waive any other laws to block the entry of people with supposedly contagious diseases. And as a practical matter, what is actually happening at the border with Title 42 is that they're not blocking the introduction or the entry of people. They are expelling people who are already in U.S. soil, already in the United States, and sending them back to Mexico or to their home countries and denying them the chance to adjust their status to a legal status like asylum or refugee status here in the United States. And so in terms of what the Supreme Court decision means, it just means, at least for now, this order will remain in place and be extended for at least a few more days while they consider the issue.
And that SCOTUS decision came at the request of state officials in several Republican state officials in several states who have been trying to keep Title 42 in place. What are the states involved? Why are they involved? And what is their argument for keeping this policy?
This is a group led by the state of Texas. The main arguments are really about immigration. It's about whether or not we're going to have more immigrants coming into the country and whether that's going to impose some harms or some costs on those states. It's really not a question of public health. And that should be what this law is about. It's supposedly about the public health necessity, which from the very beginning has always been a farce. There is never any public health rationale. The Centers for Disease Control was forced to issue this order by the Trump White House. And if you look at it as a practical matter about preventing contagious diseases from spreading in the United States, Title 42 requires these people be arrested, brought into U.S. custody, be transported. In many cases, we're flying immigrants from one part of the United States to another. So the whole public health rationale for the order makes no sense, but the states are arguing that it must be held into continued because the Biden administration did not follow a thorough enough process for rescinding that order.
Now, we've been hearing a lot about the influx of migrants going on now, even with Title 42 in place. And we've, you know, a lot of border towns, the state of Texas is concerned that if Title 42 is lifted, it will get even worse. Can you talk about why this influx, where are these migrants coming from? Why has it increased so much in recent months, particularly after President Biden took office?
Well, right. So Title 42, in theory, should apply to everyone who crosses the border. But there's practical limitations on the ability of the government to actually enforce Title 42 against every person who crosses the border. Mexico will only take certain people back. And so on the whole, over the course of the Biden administration and Trump administrations where this order has been in effect, it is mainly focused on Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Those nationals from those countries who cross the border are very likely to be returned to Mexico or to their home country. Other nationalities, very unlikely to be sent back to Mexico or to their home countries. And that's because Mexico either has a policy against accepting them back. Those countries, such as Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, we have limited diplomatic relations, so there's very few deportation flights to those countries anyway. Or it's just the limit on the number of flights. We only have so many flights that we can fly every month, about 100 per month that you think about that. That's maybe three or four a day. So there is not enough flights to fly all the people who cross the border back home. And so the Biden administration has made the decision we are going to use Title 42 primarily against these four nationalities in conjunction with Mexico and target in particular single adults who are crossing the border trying to evade detection by Border Patrol. And those nationalities and those individuals are the most likely ones to be returned to Mexico. The other ones are getting processed for asylum already, which makes the argument that it's going to greatly increase the number of asylum seekers a little bit shakier ground, because we already have a regime in which they are eligible to apply for asylum. And in fact, many asylum seekers recently told the Associated Press that they believed that this deadline on December 21st was about ending asylum, not about opening asylum, because they knew that people were already getting asylum. And so any change in U.S. policy creates this confusion south of the border. And so that's part of what we're seeing. People getting here thinking, we need to get in ahead of this deadline. We don't know what's going to happen, so we better make sure we get here because we know asylum is being processed for these countries right now.
That was Cato Institute's Stephen Beer. Next, we speak with John Herbst of the Atlantic Council, who was previously the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. We talked about Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to the U.S. earlier this week and the prospect for continued U.S. support for the war effort.
Joining us this morning is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine during the Bush administration, John Herbst. He's also a senior director at the Atlantic Council Eurasia Center. Ambassador Herbst, let's begin with this headline from the Washington Post. Russian President Putin drops special euphemistic operation and calls the invasion of Ukraine war. Your reaction, Ambassador?
Well, Putin is in trouble. His quote-unquote special military operation thus far is a failure on multiple points. He is now trying to rouse the Russian people to accept the notion of additional mobilization. So he's using the word war, and he's hoping he'll be able to rally his people, but I suspect that will fail.
I've heard reports this morning that some experts believe this may have been a slip of the tongue. You think it was intentional?
It would fit with the other things he's doing. But having said that, I can't rule out that it is a slip of the tongue, because he's tried to avoid this to suggest to the Russian people that they don't need to sacrifice much for him to achieve his aims in Ukraine. But again, those aims are not being achieved at his current level of mobilization. And if he's going to build an army of 1.5 million, which he's saying right now, which would increase the army by at least 50%, he's going to have to be calling up people far beyond the 300,000 he called up in the fall. So I think, therefore, it probably is not a slip of the tongue.
What does the state of the conflict look like right now in Ukraine?
Putin failed to seize either Kharkiv in the northeast and Kyiv in the first month or so of the war. Then he said he was going to take all of the Donbass in the east. He failed to do that. Then Ukraine launched two successful counteroffensives, one in the northeast and one in the south. And as Putin was declaring four oblasts, four provinces of Ukraine, eternal Russian territory, Ukraine was seizing territory in those areas. So he's lost at each turn, and he's now trying to figure out a way to win. And the way he has chosen thus far is a massive bombardment, a savage bombardment of Ukraine's infrastructure in the winter, destroying electricity, 50% of Ukraine's electricity grid. But all that does is make the Ukrainian people more determined to defeat his forces. So now he's talking about increasing his army so he can launch a new offensive. But he doesn't have the troops at the present time. Hundreds of thousands of Russian men fled during the mobilization in the fall. And he doesn't have the weapons because the export controls we have placed upon our exports to Russia are making much harder for him to produce weapons.
How will this recent announcement by President Biden of a new weapons system, I think it's the Patriot missiles, that how will that help Ukraine?
Well, that will help Ukraine defend itself against the air bombardment that Moscow is conducting. But it's important to point out the Patriot systems are wonderful. It's great. At this point, we're sending one, which means that this very large country, in this very large country with you know thousands of targets, they'll be able to protect one large city, like, for example, the capital, Kyiv. So it's a nice step, but it is not decisive. However, the symbolism is important. And if we send additional Patriot batteries beyond that, that will be very, very noteworthy.
Ambassador Herbst, why did the Ukrainian president visit America, visit Washington, D.C. this week? What do you think the purpose was of this visit?
I think that the White House wanted him to come, and so he came, because they wanted to demonstrate globally, but also to the American people, the strong support the administration is providing to Ukraine. The one problem with this is that the takeaway that Zelensky brought home, which is people welcomed, of course, with the Patriots, but that decision was leaked last week. So the Ukrainians thought they already had that even before Zelensky came. Nonetheless, this was an important step forward of showing American support for Ukraine as it deals with this barbaric Russian invasion.
I want to show a little bit of his speech to that joint meeting of Congress, where he makes the argument trying to convince lawmakers that the U.S. has a meaningful stake in this war.
Financial assistance is also critically important, and I would like to thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for both financial packages you have already provided us with and the ones you may be willing to decide on. Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way. Russia could stop its aggression, really, if it wanted to, but you can speed up our victory. I know it. And it will prove to any potential aggressor that no one can succeed in breaking national borders, no one committing atrocities and reigning over people against their will. It would be naive to wait for steps towards peace from Russia, which enjoys being a terrorist state. Russians are still poisoned by the Kremlin. The restoration of international legal order is our joint task.
Ambassador Herbst, did he make a convincing argument?
I think he made a very important argument. I would have phrased it a little bit differently, so Americans understand it better. Putin wants to reestablish political control over all the countries that made up the former Soviet Union. That includes three NATO allies. So if Putin were to win in Ukraine, he's going to attack our NATO allies in the Baltic states. And our troops would have to fight and die to stop that. And the economic cost to the United States of a Russian invasion into Northern and Western Europe would be far greater than the $50 billion we're sending a year to Ukraine. So it is a smart and economical way to protect American security and to protect American lives and to ensure American prosperity. We have a direct stake in defeating Putin in Ukraine. If he wins in Ukraine, the cost to the United States will be far greater.
Ambassador Herbst, before we get to calls, the Ukrainian president argues that his country can win this war outright. Do you agree?
Yes. If we provide him the weapon systems that the Biden administration is still too cautious to provide, Ukraine will win this war, and they'll win it faster.
That was the Atlantic Council's John Herbst, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.